organizers of this conference for doing such a beautiful job and for inviting me to India. So my talk will be a supergravity dual of a cascading confining gauge theory. And all of you heard about confining theories, but I'm not sure how many of you heard about cascading theories. So my number one goal is to explain what that might mean. So here is the outline of the talk. It's kind of ambitious. I'm not sure how much of this I will cover, but you can, in any case, look it up on the web later. So I want to start with just explaining why we like putting brains. Yes? Why we like putting brains at conical singularities, and what sort of non-trivial ADS-CFT dualities that gives. And then the primary new ingredient is adding rep D5 brains, which are also known as fractional D3 brains, to get non-conformal invariant theories. And I will show, based on evidence from both field theory and supergravity, that these theories exhibit novel ultraviolet behavior, which we call the RG cascade, and which is related to Seiberg dualities. Then I will address the infrared dynamics of these theories and show that the conifold where we originally put the brains, actually due to infrared defects, basically chiral symmetry breaking, becomes a deformed conifold. And the whole solution can be rather simply determined, as I did in the paper with Matt Strassler. Then this solution exhibits some of the phenomenology, quote unquote, of confining n equal 1 gauge theories. So I will address that. And it also exhibits dimensional transmutation, as shown in the paper by my student Michael Krasnitz. And then if I have time, I will talk a little bit about the very recent paper with another student, Chris Herzog, about generalizing some of these results to theories with fewer dimensions, basically, to P less than 3 theories. Okay, so I'll keep the outline here. So first, just a lightning review of ADS-CFT duality. All of you know this, but I just wanted to remind you what the structure of the three-brain solution is. Basically, you derive the duality by comparing a stack of D3 brains somewhere in flat space with this D3-brain solution, which has the structure of a warped product of the parallel metric with the transverse metric with a single warp factor H. And H is a harmonic function. So because of this, when you go to small radii, the space becomes ADS 5 crosses 5, and then the throat basically opens up. So now we want to generalize this story by sticking brains to the singularity of a cone. And then the story basically on the gravity side goes through essentially identically. The metric becomes a warp product of the parallel metric with a transverse cone metric. So you replace the metric of the 5-sphere by some other 5-dimensional Einstein metric. And the warp factor has identical form if you put the brains right at the apex of the cone. So when you go to small radii, you once again find the ADS 5 factor and the other factor, which is some other compact space other than the sphere. And then the new statement of duality due to these cone brain situations is the type 2B theory on this background is dual to the infrared field theory on the stack of brains, but now not at some flat point, but at the special singular point. And so the hard part here usually is to determine what this field theory is. This was originally done for some orbifold theories, but the example I want to talk about, which is somewhat more kind of tricky, has to do with the conifold. So the conifold is a singular non-compact Calabi-Yau manifold described by this equation and 4 complex variables. And this has the form of a cone whose base is the space T11, which is essentially a coset space. Its metric can be written very explicitly. It basically is a S1 bundle over S2 crosses 2. So here are the two spheres. And then there is an additional angle, which is bundled over it. So it's this metric which is multiplied by the, basically is that one of the product factors and the other one is the ADS5 metric. The hard part is to determine what is the N equal one field theory on the three brains at this place. And again, this is fairly old stuff, but I just want to state this fact, is that this theory turns out to be UN cross UN gauge theory with bifundamental matter. There are two chiral superfields and one bifundamental representation and another two in conjugate. And basically, there is a global SU2 cross SU2 symmetry where the first factor rotates A1 into A2 and back, and the other one rotates B1 and B2 into each other. And then there is an exactly marginal superpotential, which is the unique superpotential invariant under all the symmetries. And this pretty much, the marginality of the superpotential determines the R charges of the fields and operator dimensions, et cetera, et cetera. So this is a duality between a Seiberg type interacting fixed point theory and some smooth non-trivial geometry, which has less symmetry than the SU4 present in the maximally supersymmetric case. So now the fact, so this duality has been tested in various ways. And one particular aspect of this duality that will be important to us in this talk is the fact that the space T11 is topologically just a product of a two-sphere and a three-sphere. So we can wrap brains in new ways that were not previously available in S5. So one of these ways is to wrap D5 brains over the S2 and position the remaining dimensions parallel to the original three brains. So you can create this kind of stack right at the apex of the conifold where there are n regular D3 brains and m fractional D3 brains, which are also these D5 brains wrapped over the S2. And so Steve Gopser and I showed that then the gauge group changes to SUN plus M cross SUN, and the matter content remains the same. Okay, it's still these sets of bifundamental fields. Now, this theory is no longer conformal. It's pretty easy to show this, for example, by studying the Schiffman-Weinstein beta functions. And the main goal of here is to determine what is the supergravity dual of this theory. So the immediate observation is that after you've wrapped these D5 brains, they're going to create a new Ramon-Ramon flux. And this Ramon-Ramon flux is going to pierce the three spheres. So in addition to n units of five-form flux through the entire T11, you want to put m units of three-form Ramon-Ramon flux through the S3. And the question is, can you find a solution where both of these fluxes are present? And the whole sort of new stuff has to do with the features of the solution. Basically, this is first considered by Nekrasov and me, and we found that there is this would-be modulus, okay, the integral of Bn S and S over the S2 in the conformal theory, dual to ADS5 cross T11, it measured the difference of the couplings of the two gauge groups. Okay, this is one of the marginal deformations. Okay, but now once you turn on these two fluxes, then this integral is no longer constant throughout ADS space. It becomes radially varying. And this translates into a normalization group flow of the difference between the two coupling parameters. And so I'll skip some of the old stuff, but just exhibit a newer solution that was found by Zeitlin and me, which is an exact supergravity solution, except it's singular, and then I will deal with the singularity. So the solution is really very simple to state. This omega 2 is a harmonic 2 form, which is a difference between the volume forms of the two spheres. I'm just keeping it, denoting it like this. And then you find that this BNS and S field is exactly logarithmic in the radial variable. And the 10-dimensional metric, surprisingly, is still the same type of warped product that you saw in the simple old D3 brain metric, okay? Except that the form of this warp factor changes. In addition to the usual 1 over r to the 4 term, there is an additional logarithmic term. And furthermore, the 5-form field strength, due essentially to the same effect, acquires also a logarithmic dependence. This really comes about from the Chern-Simons term, because BNSNS wedge HRR has a logarithmic dependence on the radius. And there is such a term in the full five-form field strength. So this is the background, basically dual to this collection of deep brains, and therefore it should be dual to this non-trivial, non-conformal field theory. And the immediate observation is that it has some new UV behavior. This extra logarithm appeared, and this means that this integral of F5, the flux, actually starts to vary with the scale. Basically, every time this BNSNS field goes through the period, because it's a periodic variable, n really decreases by m units. And the question is, so if you start with some very large n in the infrared, it's going to dynamically decrease in these steps until it essentially becomes zero or some small number. And now the other feature of the solution is, because of this logarithm, there is a naked singularity at some value of the radius. Okay. So first of all, here is an interpretation of these jumps of n, which was invented by Strassler and me. And this has to do with basically Seiberg duality. When you study how the couplings flow due to these Schiffmann-Weinstein beta functions, you find that the bigger gauge group hits an infinite coupling point, okay, pretty soon after you've started flowing. And then you just apply the duality to this factor, after which it becomes SUNF minus NC. And when you do the simple calculation of what is the effective number of flavors in this theory, it's basically 2n. So this gauge group becomes SUN minus m. So from SUN cross SUN plus m, you get SUN minus m cross SUN. So already at this stage, a jump has occurred and decreased by m units. Okay, and then this happens, and then the flow, the directions of the flow reversed, because now this is the bigger gauge group. So now this starts flowing to stronger coupling. Here I'm plotting inverse couplings. And then the next jump occurs, and so on. And that's why we call it the duality cascade, that couplings flow within some theory, then you hit an infinite coupling at one of the gauge groups, then you dualize, and so on. And this fits remarkably well with what the supergravity tells you, because this five-form field strength indeed just keeps decreasing. And in fact, when G string M is much bigger than 1, then you can write the supergravity warp factor in this simple form. Okay, I've just shifted the radial coordinate like this. And this shows that away from this singular point R star, the supergravity is reliable, but it has a naked singularity at r equal to r star. Okay, and the question is, what is the origin of this singularity? And I want to argue that this solution is actually not correct. It's only correct in the UV, but it becomes increasingly more and more incorrect as you proceed to small radii. And this is because we've really put too much symmetry in this solution. This solution does not know about the chiral symmetry breaking, which takes place in the dual gauge theory. So what really happens is that the simplest case to study is you imagine if the theory has cascaded down to the point where there is just one regular brain and m fractional brains. So it's an SUM plus one gauge theory with two quark flavors. Dynamics of such theories has been studied extensively in the 80s. And Affleck, Dine, and Seiberg show that there is an induced superpotential in addition to the original superpotential term that we wrote down. If you minimize, if you extremize the whole superpotential, you find that this determinant of Nij, and Nij is Cd, has M solutions. And these M solutions are rotated into each other by the Z to M R symmetry, which we heard about from Dory in the previous talk. So you find that this is just the symmetry breaking from Z to M down to Z2. And moreover, so without this term, you would just find that the moduli space for this regular brain is the conifold, namely Nij, determinant Nij is equal to zero. Because of this extra term, determinant Nij is really a constant. And this space is known as the deformed conifold. Okay? So another way to write this deformed manifold is to make a change of variables, okay, into the what we call the original variables. So if I rename Nij into Zij, form these linear combinations, you find that the deformed manifold is just, you know, instead of putting a zero on the right-hand side, you put a constant on the right-hand side. And this deformation clearly breaks the U1R symmetry present in the conformal case. Because the conformal case, you can just rotate all the z's by the same phase, and now this is not available. Only you can just reverse the sign of the z's, okay? So therefore, so what happens is that the U1R symmetry, which is the large M approximation to the Z2M, in fact, if you do a more careful study, as shown by Maldacena and Nunez, what happens is that this U1R is broken down to Z2M by the instanton effects. But in the large M limit, this is a small effect, so to speak. So you see that the chiral symmetry breaking in the geometrical language just corresponds to deforming the manifold, putting this epsilon squared here. Okay, and the amazing thing is that if you do this on the gravity side, this actually resolves the naked singularity problem. And the geometrical reason is because at the apex, the two-sphere shrinks to, so basically T11 is S2 cross S3. But in the deformed manifold, they don't shrink at the same rate. And when S2 shrinks to zero size, S3 still remains finite. And this exactly is what's needed to cure the singularity, because this S3 drawn here I'm being schematic, S3 is pierced by this conserved flux. So if some surface is pierced by flux, it doesn't want to shrink to zero. That creates an infinite energy problem. So it's really this conserved F3 flux that deforms the manifold and supports this finite S3 while the S2 shrinks to zero. So I think it's a remarkable agreement between chiral symmetry breaking pictures on the field theory and dual gravity side, okay? There are sort of two parallel lines of reasoning which lead to basically introducing the same type of phenomena. So I will not exhibit the details of the solution we found with Matt. You can, because it would just take too long, but let me just say that the metric is, again, writable in this very simple single warp product form where tau is the radius of the deformed manifold and ds6 squared is the Calabi-Yau metric on the deformed manifold. So once again, all you did is you replaced the manifold by the deformed manifold here. And moreover, the complex 3 form, which is the Ramon-Ramon plus I times an SNS3 form, is that we determined it exactly in terms of just hyperbolic functions. And this turns out to be a 2,1 form on this Calabi-Yau space. And this is precisely the condition necessary to preserve the N equal 1 supersymmetry as shown by these authors. Moreover, the warp factor is also known explicitly. And you can check that at large radius, it approaches the one that was found in the solution that Seitlin and I found. Essentially, tau becomes log r, and you find that at large tau and large r, the solution is the same as before. At small tau, the warp factor just approaches a constant, and this implies that at small tau, there is neither a naked singularity nor a horizon, okay? It's just a smooth sort of tip of the cigar, so to speak. And this, in turn, implies the aerial offer for the Wilson loop. That's a totally standard statement. Once you have a space like that, what happens is essentially that if you put a Wilson loop binding some quark and an antiquark, most of the string connecting them will just go to the tau equal zero location. And because the coefficient of the dx parallel squared in the metric is just something finite, you find the linear potential between quarks. And the related statement is that the spectrum of glue balls, namely normalizable wave functions on this smooth space, can be determined. And no surprise, it's discrete, as was shown by these authors. So one can do similar type of glue ball calculations that were done, for example, in Witten's thermal approach to confining theory, basically putting a black hole in ADS approach. Okay, So another interesting statement is that the presence of a finite S3, okay, explains some of the quote-unquote phenomenology of a confining n equal 1 theory. Namely, for example, if you look at a D3 brain wrapped over an S3, you can show that because of this Ramon-Ramon flux, it must have M strings emanating from it. In other words, it's not a finite energy object because it has this extra flux coming out of it. And these M strings, you can think of them as M external quarks. Basically, their ends will be M external quarks. So this is the baryon vertex of the resulting SUM theory that you find, okay, at the end of the cascade. Then you can take a D5 brain, wrap it over the S3, and create a domain wall in the remaining directions. And this, so we know that because of Z2M down to Z2 breaking, there are M inequivalent vacua, and this domain wall is what separates two inequivalent vacua in the gauge theory. Okay, so you can do some other things, and basically you found somehow, it seems like this finite S3 puts in a lot of the right structure into this somewhat crude description. So the other observation is that for large G-string M, because the whole warp factor has a G-string M squared outside it, for large G-string M, curvatures are small everywhere, the space is non-singular, and we find a reliable dual of a cascading confining theory. Okay, so then you can ask, what is this cascade? I mean, there is this extra logarithm. This just means that if you go to large R, there is unbounded growth of the number of colors N. Okay, so the theory becomes SUN plus M cross SUN with enormous N. And N grows without bound. The question is this a local quantum field theory? And one would like to study the physics of the theory some more. So a very simple thing you can study is, for example, the two-point function in this theory. You can do it during just completely standard methods. Put some boundary conditions at infinite R. You can map infinite R to zero Y by just this mapping. Okay, and just study the solution of this equation. Totally standard stuff. The analog of what was done by Gabser, Polyakov, and me, and by Witten in the basic ADS in the conformal invariant case. So you put these boundary conditions at the boundary, and you find that this extra log is actually a small effect. It doesn't really screw up the perturbation theory in this case. Okay, because there are basically two derivatives here and no just a log and not, say, log over y squared on this side. So you want to find from this the two-point function. So you want to determine this constant C by matching to the small r solution. And the constant C turns out to have two more powers of the log compared to the conformal case. So when you finally determine the two-point function from the value of the action, which is just the boundary term, you find that it's k to the 4 log cube k in momentum space. And transforming to position space, you find that, say, the two-point function corresponding to a minimally coupled massless scalar is 1 over x to the 8 times log squared of x over some scale. And now the interpretation, we believe, is that there should be some factor of n squared, right? In the conformal case, this would be just n squared over x to the 8. And all that happens is that here, the effective number of colors is really dependent on the momentum or on separation of the vertex operator. The closer you move them together, the more colors you excite, and this explains this extra logarithmic growth. Okay? So just as, say, in an asymptotically free theory, you find some extra logarithms in the two-point functions. And then when you look at, so this is the behavior at large momenta, or in turn, short distances, short compared to the scale and the logarithm. Now, at scales which are long compared to the logarithm, you simply find this discrete spectrum of glue balls, and the two-point function is just going to fall off exponentially with the mass, which again is determined by the scale in the logarithm. And this is precisely dimensional transmutation, okay? So even though this theory is not asymptotically free because both gauge groups flow while their average coupling stays strong, nevertheless, there are these extra logs and there is dimensional transmutation. Okay, so this is, I think it would make sense to probably do more calculations to check this interpretation, but it appears to be a plausible interpretation. Then finally, a comment on whether we can get to not a cascading theory, but just to, I have just 3 more minutes. Not to a cascading theory, but just to the pure N equal 1 SUM. And here the story is similar to the story in the previous talk, that we're kind of in the opposite limit that where we need to be. Because what happens is that this cascade at large G string M is happening very fast. So the region where the theory is pure SUM is confined to very small tau. Now, if you want this pure SUM phase, sort of after the last jump of the cascade, to expand, you really need to take G string M to zero rather than infinity. And then the supergravity approximation would not be applicable. And then we have to resort to the dreaded string sigma model with Ramon-Ramon couplings, which I think is the number one problem in this field in any case. And it just might be that this situation is sufficiently different from, say, the ADS 5 crosses 5 that perhaps a new angle can be found on this problem. Nevertheless, I want to emphasize that just pure supergravity does give us an honest dual throughout the entire range of this somewhat bizarre cascading confining theory. And then just in the last 2 minutes, I want to show you that that in very recent work, we tried to generalize these results to other dimensionalities of brains. And we haven't yet found analogs of the solution with Strassler, but we found analogs of the solution I found with Seitlin. Namely, these are typically singular solutions, but the transverse space is simple. It's a cone. So you basically take some conical transverse space, and the amazing thing is that the ansatz you need is precisely the same as in the old DP brain solutions. Okay, except the warp factor, again, acquires a new term due to the extra flux that you put in. So basically, the base of the cone needs a 2-cycle, and you wrap brains around this 2-cycle, then the omega 2 is the harmonic form corresponding to the cycle. Then you have exactly, again, saturation of the Chern-Simons term, and you again find solutions with radially varying flux, similar to and many other such solutions were found by Cvetich, Liu, and Pope, and Cvetich, Gibbons, Liu, and Pope. Okay, so one explicit example, which is very similar to the T11, but it corresponds to 1+1 dimensional theory, is when you take these strings and put them on a cone over a coset space Q111, which is well known from the old supergravity literature because people compactified 11D supergravity on it. And you find that we have a proposal for what is the N equal 2 supersymmetric theory dual to it. It now has 3 sets of these fields which realize SU2 cubed symmetry. You again have varying Ramon-Ramon flux. So this N, again, effectively becomes scale dependent. And the question is this a Seiberg duality cascade? It might not be. There is another possible interpretation, which is Higgsing, as emphasized by Aroni in a recent paper. So just to conclude, in this case too, and hopefully in other cases, we expect the same triangle to occur that we found in the solution with Strassler, namely that to resolve naked singularity, you need to deform the cone. This in turn corresponds to the infrared dynamics of the gauge theory. And it would be interesting to find it, for example, in this 1+1 dimensional example. So I hope this is not the last word on this story. Thank you.
Any questions?
So in case the bottom of the cascade isn't SUM times U1, but SUM times SU7 or something like that, what is different in the story?
I think in that case you just have, if you have a few more actual D3 brains moving in the background, in the supergravity background.
So you produce the same deform particle but with some explicit D3 brains.
That's what we believe. But I don't have very, many checks on this proposal, but we do have some checks.
The duality cascade, on the face of it, seems like it involves a series of sharp transitions where one gauge coupling or another diverges. And yet the supergravity solution is smooth. Can you elaborate on how the apparent singularities get smoothed out?
Well, I think in the large G-string M limit, the cascade is happening so fast that basically the distance between the steps of the cascade is sent to zero in the limit where G-string M goes to infinity. So it's possible that only in this limit do you have this sort of smooth soup picture. And once you really do the account for stringy effects more, you will see a series of sharp transitions.
Thanks.
Any more questions?
Does the Lagrangian, do you think that the Lagrangian of the theory defines the theory completely, this cascading theory in the ultraviolet? Is this a well-defined, new kind of well-defined quantum field theory?
Well, I think what we could see is that when you're dealing with every given phase of the cascade where you have SUN plus M cross SUN, then there does seem to be a well-defined superpotential. And sort of one of our arguments for why this cascade is possible in this theory is that the Seiberg duality is kind of self-similar. It takes a superpotential and after the transformation gives you exactly the same type of superpotential. So in some sense, maybe you can regard this as a Lagrangian definition. But granted, I mean, maybe this can be viewed as a definition of SU infinity cross SU infinity plus M. I don't know. But
if you put this Lagrangian on a lattice, I mean, philosophically, you think you'd get sensible results in the continuum?
I think on any kind of lattice, the cascade will probably be cut off somewhere. Because, well, for example, as reminded me by De Boer at this conference, sir, one way to do something to the cascade far in the UV is simply to add 1 to the warp factor, or add epsilon to the warp factor, which we know corresponds to adding trace F to the 4 irrelevant operators to the gauge theory. And then it will sort of cascade for a very, very long time, and then the solution will start opening up, and that will cut off the cascade. So you can alter the cascade by further addition of irrelevant operators. And we are somehow taking the limit where all of this is fine-tuned to zero so that the cascade seems to proceed without stopping.
Any other questions? Okay, so if there are no questions, let us thank Professor Klebanov again. So we'll